We welcome Mr. Pappas this morning.
Thank you, Willie. Thank you very much, and I'm glad to be speaking here at the Principals Leadership Conference. We're going to be talking about rigor, relevance, and content reading strategies, and we'll get right into it. As far as the essential skill that we're looking at, because this conference really is about essential skills, the skill we're focusing in on here is instructional leadership. And if you folks are coming in late, I'd like you to pick up a handout, and there's a response unit up there, okay? Willie, maybe you could kind of post yourself there. Great. And to some extent, I'm going to be giving you an opportunity to think a little bit about your school's vision for instruction. I'll be introducing the rigor and relevance model and trying to show you how that ought to look in the classroom as you're getting around looking at the actual application of the model. We'll be talking certainly about supporting literacy while improving content knowledge. And lastly, how to foster a more engaging student-centered classroom. So those are all parts of this presentation. This is me when I got started. As Willie said, I've been doing this for over 30 years, 34 years to be exact. I retired last year. I started in a very small rural school with 300 kids, K through 12. It was actually considered part of the Appalachian school program. And that's me back in 1970-71. Right, and that's my hair, I think. Maybe. Just a quick synopsis of the career. I spent a lot of time in the classroom. I was a teacher for 25 years and had an opportunity to work in a number of different environments. I've worked here. I've worked in a large suburban district, a very affluent population, worked in an urbanized a district with greater high needs population. About 25 years in, I've shifted over and became a K-12 program director and then spent the last 5 years as an assistant superintendent of schools. I was never a principal. So there goes my credibility, right? He doesn't know what it's like at the district office, right? Yeah, okay. Reference my website because I think there's a lot of good stuff there, and I think there's a lot of good stuff there because people tell me, and they tell me both when they meet me, but they also tell me by their traffic. I get well over 1,000 visitors daily. They average about, 12, 14 minutes apiece. Some of the material that I have there might in a typical month be downloaded over 1,000 times. So there's a lot of good material there. So you might want to reference this site, lots of showcase of projects and so forth. Also, I for the last about 15 years have been working as a presenter and a trainer and am now affiliated with the International Center for Leadership and Education, which is Willard Daggett's organization. I'm one of their senior consultants. And so I am available to do everything from keynotes and conference presentations right on down to train the trainer and in-house faculty training, which I do an awful lot of, especially now that I don't have that day job anymore. My goal, this is just a map of some of my more recent clients. I actually figured out how to make a Google map of that, so you can click in and see them. This is all on the website. This is a key point to me. I think training ought to look like what we want to see in the classroom, you know? And unfortunately, not a lot of it always is. I mean, a lot of it is just people reading PowerPoints to you, okay? So one of the things I really like to pride myself on with the training I do with teachers is I want to put the teachers through the experience of exactly what I'd like to see them doing with the kids. So that'll be a little bit of kind of the focus we'll take today. I'd like to put in a plug for a presentation I'm doing later in the day. It's about publishing, but it's really about rigor and relevance and action. And I don't know if you're aware of it, but it is now possible to make a high quality, let me just pull this out here. You can now publish a high quality paperback book like this with color pages, nice cover, and you can make a book like this for $10. And you know how many you have to make? One. So I've been working with a whole variety of clients, everything from ESSEL students talking about their lives, to second graders doing 6+1, to I've worked a lot with incarcerated youth around New York State, and we've been publishing books. And it's invigorating for the kids, it's engaging for the teachers, and the technology is right there. In fact, you don't really need a ton of training. So if you're interested in hearing more about that, stop back to that next session. Also, if you go to my blog, you know, you got to have a blog these days, right? I will upload a more updated version of the presentation that you're looking at, because this handout you have was made a month ago, and I always get some new ideas. I'm also audio taping this, so that'll be available if you want to subject yourself to my voice at the gym or something like that. You can download it onto your iPod. It should make you run very well, you know, if you really think about that. Okay. The audience response system. Everybody got one? Right? Okay, there's some little buttons on there, and I'm going to give you chances to press buttons. By the way, you don't have to aim it at the screen. You know, a lot of people think that they're changing the channel, but it's actually just bouncing around the room and being picked up by my laptop. Typically, how I use these is to, first of all, to engage the audience a bit. But the other thing we can do if we had more time, this is kind of a shorter session today, if this were a full day session, we could use it to generate discussion. The other thing is when I'm doing training, frequently I'll be working with teams of teachers and we'll actually generate data during the talk, and then when they go into breakout groups, we output the data in graphic form so people have something to look at. What I find is very interesting though, is that it's a great strategic planning tool. You can find consensus in a room very, very easily. So I'll be kind of using it just as a way to keep you awake and have some fun, but I'd like you to be thinking about some of these uses because it's great for that. Now, just to get started, we've got to give you some experience using it. So here's your question. Feather is the peacock, his scale is 2, and you're just going to find on your little keypad there a 1, 2, 3, or 4. And when you press the button, you should see a little green light go on there. And we're going to let you vote in. Okay, and we'll see what you know about biology. Okay, let's see how we did here. You're a very sharp group. You know, I frequently get a lot of sharks in there. Okay, let's try another one. How about brain is to processor as eyes are too? I know I'm going to be in front of you all day here. So.
Oh, you're fine.
See, it's the techie question. Okay, let's give you another second here, and let's see what we got. Oh, interesting. Somebody want to tell us why they thought it was a webcam or a monitor? Anybody? Come on. This is the audience participation part. Remember, we're small learning community? This is it. We're it. So someone want to tell us why they thought it was the webcam or the monitor? Because we got a bit of disagreement there. Come on. Oh, come on. Thank you.
It was the webcam, because the webcam is taking in information.
Okay.
And the brain just as the eyes.
All right. Anyone want to make a case for the monitor? Which is the wrong answer? Good. It's good. You're not doing that. Okay. Here's one you should be able to answer. Where are you working? And I don't know if there's others in here besides district office, but if you could just click in one of those. I was curious to just see the level of the folks we have in here. Let's see. Oh, about a third of each, nearly. Okay. Typically what I do, for example, I'm going to be in Carmel, California later this week, and I do the, that's a nice place to have to work, isn't it? Yeah, I know. They're real. I think I'm paying them to do, no, actually they're paying me. I'm spending one whole session with K-5, another whole session with 6-12, which works a little bit better. So I'm gonna try and mix it up with some examples at different levels here, because we have kind of a K-12 spread. All right, let's take a look at rigor and relevance. What do we mean by this? And really getting kids to take on the challenge of the intellectual work. Now, we start with Bloom's taxonomy, which I know you're all very aware of. And as we talk about rigor, what we are referencing is where it falls on Bloom. So if we're talking about a program that is more academically or more intellectually rigorous, we're talking about a program that affords kids the opportunity to work at the upper level of Bloom, at the higher order thinking skills, as opposed to spending most of their time down here. And teachers generally understand this, okay? This is a pretty simple point to make. Now, what I'd like to do, and this is a question that always fascinates me, from your experience as a teacher, an administrator, a parent, an uncle or aunt, I'd like you to think about the earliest point in the development of a child when they're capable of essentially a higher order thinking skill. And I'm going to give you a scenario. I'm going to say where we gave the student a selection of familiar objects and we asked them to classify them. Okay? Now, you could be scaffolding and modeling the task, but eventually they're going to do it independently. They should be able to tell you why things got put in different classifications, even though they might not certainly use the word classification. And as a little test, if you were to add a new object, they'd be able to either put it in a category that sort of made some sense with their system, or perhaps change their system to accommodate the new object. So my question to you is, what's the earliest level that a student of average ability could perform this kind of task? Okay? So here you've got to look carefully, because there's 1 through 0, and like 5 corresponds with grade 3-4. So kind of pick your grade and go over here your age. So what's the earliest level that you think a child of average ability could do this? Again, it's items that they're familiar with. And they're developing a classification system. Okay, I think we've got about everybody in there. Let's see. Okay. Well, this is very interesting, because when I'm oftentimes with a high school audience of teachers, they'll push this number down here somewhere. So I've been gathering data in different audiences. So it's interesting from your perspective. Anyone have an example of a very young child classifying something? Anybody think of something? Yeah.
I was just thinking of a child when they first started developing the taste for vegetables and how they, on their little tray, start to sort
and pick.
Okay. I mean, it's a non-verbal thing. It's a classification system.
Okay. Anybody else think of a classification? Sure.
My child put the markers.
Okay, she sorts them out. I have a 25-year-old who I can remember sorting out his Star Wars figures into types of guys. You know, again, he must have been 3 or 4. Okay, so obviously what's happening is higher order thinking is not something that doesn't start until you get to middle school or doesn't start to get to high school. It's really the question of how do you scaffold the task. So as we talk about rigor, I'm suggesting that you can have a rigorous program right on down to, you know, primary level. Okay? It's just the tasks are going to look a little bit differently. Now, here's where we start to get into the relevance side, because we all know that rigor's the kind of vertical, but the horizontal is, how are you going to use information? In other words, are you going to use information kind of in a school-only setting, or to what extent is it going to be used in life? All right, and this is just an example that I picked up from a book by Phyllis Witten. This is Justin, a second grader, talking about math, and he says, math is when you add or subtract numbers and your teacher will make sure you have the right answer. So look at what Justin already in the second grade thinks. Only right answers count. Teachers tell you when you get those right answers. You work by yourself to solve a problem. And of course, look at this looming teacher. Little Justin. So already you're starting to see very early on in an academic career where kids are starting to distance themselves from their learning. It's not their job. It's really something they're sort of watching happen to them. Here's another example. This is a question from the NAEP test. A cruise ship carries 200 passengers and crew. Lifeboat carries 30 passengers. How many lifeboats will the ship need? Okay, one-third of the eighth graders that took the test answered six, remainder 20. Okay. And finally, here's a quote from Wiggins and McTighe, and I'll let you read it. So here's the valedictorian of a class, and she doesn't really own her own learning. So when we talk about relevance, we're talking about moving from using skills and knowledge strictly in school out to using skills and knowledge for myself in the real world. Okay? And these are really key points, and I added these. These are not in your handout, so I want to give you a chance to focus on this. By relevance, I do not simply mean it's got a real world look to it. You know, in other words, we're going to do math, but I'm going to have you do a budget, and you're going to keep track of what you're paying for rent and your car payments, you know, and all that. I'm really also talking about relevance in terms of a child making connection with their learning, in terms of the fact that it has an application in life, that the child has the opportunity to construct some understanding as opposed to just learning the facts. And finally, that a relevant experience is one where in addition to learning content and skills, kids are learning how they learn, because that's also important. So let's put this all in a framework. On our vertical scale here, we have rigor, with a dividing point on the vertical axis just of the lower order thinking, A and B, and the higher order thinking above this dotted line at the upper levels of Bloom, which are C and D. And on the horizontal axis, we're just going to arbitrarily say we've got anything to the left of this line is going to have a low level of relevance. In other words, it's really kind of school only. Kids are not connected to their learning. Anything to the right of this dotted line, this vertical one, is going to have a much higher level of relevance. And let's look at the four quadrants of learning then. In quadrant A, basically kids are gathering and storing information. They're doing lower order thinking, and they're not terribly connected to it. It's a very teacher-directed task. So, for example, on the quiz on Friday, they're picking the right definition. And it may look exactly the way it was given to them. Quadrant B is lower order thinking, but it's being applied in a real life situation. And so students in this case might be able to use their math skills and life skills to decide if it made sense for them to lease a car or perhaps take out a loan. And that would allow some judgment. They'd have to decide how it was that they were going to make that comparison. They may even have to go get the data themselves, you know, from the newspaper. Quadrant C, this is what we tend to do with our more high-performing students, is we put them in a very school-directed environment to perform a higher order thinking task, where the teacher says, this is how I want it done, this is what it ought to look like, this is the format, these are the steps, here's all the material. You know, it's the lab that says if you do this, 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 and this, you should get that. Here's the steps in how this math problem's done, and you ought to get an answer that looks like this. And finally, quadrant D, which again is higher order thinking, but it's in much more of the, we'll say, fluid, unpredictable world that we all face every day, which is we don't exactly know how things are going to turn out. We have to negotiate meaning. And you know, you, as building administrators, this is your whole life, right? The phone rings in the morning and suddenly your whole day changed. Okay. Now, if you have teachers that are teaching in these four quadrants, we want to make sure that the assessments are in alignment with the quadrant, with the instructional goal. So in other words, if they say, gee, I'm really doing a higher order thinking skill, it's got a high level of relevance, it's up here, but I'm going to assess it with a quiz, you know, that doesn't work. And another important thing, because a lot of times folks might have been to one of the model schools conference, and they call me in and they say, I want you to, you know, an assistant superintendent or someone will say, I want you to come in and train all the teachers to teach in quadrant D. And I immediately say, it's not about teaching in quadrant D. It's about knowing where you're teaching, understanding there's good places to be, and that you have to orchestrate the movement through the various quadrants. So it's not about just teaching in D. It's really having a very purposeful movement and understand that you really have quite a palette to work with. Now, just a question for you. You know, you get around, you observe a lot of lessons. You've probably been doing this a while. You were teachers at one point. If you were to walk down and observe all the classrooms of America today, what quadrant do you think would account for most of the lessons being taught? Right now, all across America. We're looking at all of them. Okay, we'll close the polls here. Let's see what we got. All right, and that's an answer I frequently get. In fact, Benjamin Bloom talked in the 50s about the fact that most instruction was at the knowledge level. So that's the lower order of Bloom. So most all of you, you know, over 90% agreed that it's largely lower order thinking going on. It's either A or B, with kind of a 2-to-1 split between whether it was kind of a low or a high level of relevance. Now, here's another question. Where do you think the teacher has to work the hardest? And I've intentionally left this as an ambiguous point because I'm not sure what you think is hard work for a teacher. But in which quadrant do you think teachers have to work the hardest? Okay, let's see. Well, that's interesting. Someone want to tell us why they think teachers work the hardest in quadrant A? Anybody? Come on, and I want to hear some discussion. I'm not going to sit here and stare at you all day.
There's less independent motivation. Kids are not as excited about what they're doing. They're just spitting back knowledge and receiving knowledge as they are when they're highly involved.
Okay, so in that case, you're saying it's hard work because you're kind of dragging the kids along.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. It's teacher-directed, so it's teacher-prepared. They do all the work. Kids just spit it back.
Okay, so if it's a teacher-centered classroom, the teachers are working. Anybody else? Thoughts on A? I used to teach in A. You know, when I first started, I was a high school social studies teacher, and I put on 5 shows daily. You know, I got up and I lectured and I was a lot of fun. And you know what? I was the one who was reading all the books. I was the one who was, man, did I learn a lot. I just learned a ton of stuff. And, you know, I did this for a while. And, that, you know, I would go in the teacher's lounge. And, of course, back then you could smoke in the teacher's lounge. You know, so there was just this billows of smoke would come out. And you see these people just sitting there like this talking about retirement. You know, of course, they're like 40 years old. And I'm going, oh, my God, that's not going to become me. So I, without knowing this model, I really started to try and move to more student-centered. But a lot of you said that D constitutes pretty hard work for teachers. Why? Anybody want to tell us why they think D? Yes, in the back.
I said D because I think the planning is harder than it is in Part A. To develop the lesson plan that will involve and engage the students. The actual teaching of the lesson, I don't think, is as difficult as it is in Part A.
Okay. And another point back here, yeah?
I think particularly, going along with that, there aren't a whole lot of resources out for teachers to have, you know, a more student-based classroom. And I also think that student-based classrooms would be within the classroom, and so even if there were those resources, they wouldn't necessarily fit the classroom that you're teaching.
Okay. Another good reason, and I think somebody here had a hand up, or, yeah.
I was just going to say that the teacher has to be intentional about what they're doing, and I don't think our teachers are real focused on whether they're doing it intentionally or if they're just falling on it.
Right. Yeah, and then, of course, that teacher's resource book, right? What's that aimed at? That's at A. I mean, you know. So that big thing they get, like, here's the textbook, here's the teacher's resource book, here's all the other stuff, is certainly aiming at A. Ironically, when I started doing a lot more teaching in D, what I found was that after a large amount of preparation on my part, I had very good stuff. And ironically, even though I taught a lot of different subjects, I had mastered how to get people to do things in different settings. So it actually got very easy, because it sort of didn't matter what the content was. It was all about getting people to work together around a task. So I think if teachers learn those skills, it's actually works out nicely. And then, of course, the other thing is during the course of the day, you're not spending all your time presenting and usually trying to hold kids' attention, which means classroom management issues and all that other stuff. So, okay. Yeah, I think that certainly this is where teachers are doing a lot of work, and you've really got students as passive learner. And I think the roles really change here for the student in the other three quadrants. These are questions, you know, as I started observing teachers, because the district where I was the assistant superintendent, I had taught everyone about rigor and relevance. I'd worked with the principals. We had all kind of got on the same page. So when I went out and did observations, these are the kinds of questions I asked the students as I was floating around the room. And these, I don't think, are on your sheet. But again, if you go to the blog, you can download a brand new one that looks exactly like this and even has our data on it. Because really, it's the kids that are going to be the ones that determine for you as the observer whether or not they're constructing any sense of connection to what's going on in the classroom. And you can usually see that just by looking at them. But frequently, if you ask some questions like this, it's useful too. These are very scary questions for most teachers to ask. You know? I mean, if you were to walk into a classroom and start tossing these around, people get a little nervous. Because the real reason that we're doing a lot of things in the classroom is because that's what we're supposed to do. And frequently, teachers will tell you, well, it's because I got to cover for the test. See, one of the things I'm finding now is that all the new assessments and whatever are not making for a more rigorous and relevant classroom. They're actually making for a less of one. And teachers are saying, well, I've got all this testing to do. A lot of what I've tried to do is try to show teachers how you can help prepare kids for the test and still have an engaging classroom. But for a lot of them, that's a bit of an either-or proposition. Well, enough of talking about rigor and relevance. Let's do it. Okay, so we're going to play Survivor. So in your handout on page, where are we now? We're about page 4. Okay, here's the scenario. All right, it's 10 a.m. in August, and you've been flying in a plane with a small group of people. The plane has just crashed in the Sonora Desert of the Southwest. And the plane burned, but the frame is still there. The pilot is dead. You're not injured. Okay? The pilot could not tell anyone of the position. There's only two things you know about where you are. You know you're 70 miles from a mining camp, and you know you're about 65 miles off the flight plan you filed. Okay? Now, you were able to salvage 10 things from the plane, and we're going to go through those 10, and I'm going to ask you, working with a partner or something like that, some people near you, to try to prioritize those 10 items from number 1, which is the most valuable item, to number 10, which is the least. Okay, so 1 is the most valuable. And these are your 10 items. Okay? You got a parachute, a topographic map of the area, your 4-CD set of Cher's Greatest Hits, a book called Edible Animals of the Desert, a handgun with bullets, a magnetic compass, a bottle of salt tablets, 1 overcoat for each person in your group, a flashlight, and 2 liters of vodka. Okay? So, get started. You're working with somebody nearby. I'd like you to rank these on a 1 to 10 basis, with 1 being the most important item and 10 being the least important. And work together on this. How are we doing? All right. Okay.
checking it out?
I've done this exercise before.
Oh, have you?
In a leadership class.
Yeah.
It's exciting that what people are going to choose.
Yeah.
Because I know what I chose.
Uh-huh.
And after we did it, I could see that what I'm not thinking was absolutely wrong.
That's good. Okay, just another minute or two here to make some choices, even if you don't get all 10. Okay, what I would like you to do, just for the sake of time, we can normally take quite a lot of time with this, but I'd like you just to ring in your top three, okay? And again, zero is sort of our choice 10, so just pick in your pick your top three choices. I'll give you a minute here. Okay, we're going to close the polls here in a second. Okay. So let's take a look and see how people voted. All right, so we got, looks like the greatest amount was for the compass, and second was the topographic map, and third is what? Edible animals. Okay. So somebody want to tell us what they were planning on doing? Anybody? Or does somebody want to tell us why they think the compass and the topographic map were selected by as the two leading items? Anybody?
Use it to get where we're going, to the mining camp, quick.
Okay. So I'm going to use it to get to the mining camp. Any other ideas that people had, or either to tell us what their planning was? You were going to go to the camp. How many people were going to hike out? Raise your hands. So we got a bunch of you. Okay, we had a lot of you. And obviously, I guess that's what you do with a map and a compass, right? You go someplace. Okay. We had a lot of you pick edible animals of the desert. Why? See, you know, you got some... something to eat. Okay, we got a compass, we got a flashlight, parachute. Parachute was kind of popular. Shade, yeah. For shelter, okay. And then kind of low with share and vodka. We, you know, yeah, it's tough to party. Who could party in this situation? Okay, well, yeah. Oh, the CD's a mirror. Okay, a reflector. Oh, okay. So some of you rated that kind of high. All right. Well, let me show you. Let's talk first about your primary objective. What was your primary objective? Okay, I heard get out alive, survival. Any other primary objectives? Did many of you sit down and make a decision as to what your primary objective was?
No.
So what you did is you just started allocating resources to an objective you didn't know. That's right, we're administrators, right? That's what we do. We make plans. So without really knowing what your objective was, you started making a plan, right? No, I'm just kidding. Actually, if there are superintendents here, they really make plans. So, you know. So if your objective was to stay alive, what was the barrier to that objective? But specifically what? All right, the desert and the heat, and what's going to prevent you from staying alive for months? Water. And I hear some food. Okay. So really, then, what becomes the best use of resources? See, I mean, this is the real question. This is a resource allocation question, but before you allocate the resources, you really ought to think about why. Now, I want to show you what the survival experts who actually designed this ranked them. Okay? And before I do, I would like to tell you that if you were going to try and hike out, the survival experts would tell you you're dead within about a day. Because to the survival expert, the most precious resource is the water you have in your body, the moisture, and anything you do to expend it is bad. And the best thing to do is just stay put, be seen, be rescued. You're easy to spot in one place as opposed to a little speck on the desert. So all of you hikers that had to do something, had to take action, you're all dead. Okay. Number one item to the experts. See, you got it back there, didn't you? Share's greatest hits, because it's a mirror. That's your best signaling device. It can actually be seen over the horizon. The reflected sun can bend right over the horizon. Number two is the overcoats to keep the dry air away from your moist skin. You know, you layer up. Three is the flashlight, which is a night signaling device. Four was the parachute, which is shade. It also helps you be seen. Now, as we get to the midpoint here, we've got some good and bad things about these. The handgun's a great signaling device, but since you're getting delirious after a few hours, it may not be a good thing to have around. The magnetic compass, well, if you're not going anywhere, isn't very useful, nor is the topographic map. You know, a lot of you wanted to go run around and chase little bunnies and things and shoot them and then eat them. How long does it take to starve to death?
7 days.
Yeah, like a week or something. You're not going to starve to death. What are you chasing all these little gophers for? Forget it. You don't need to eat. Okay. And you certainly don't need vodka, and you really don't need salt tablets, which is a real myth. Yeah. So, here's a question for you. What was more engaging, doing Survivor or my lecture? Why? Okay, tell us what was going on when you were there working on Survivor. Tell us some of the things that were happening. Somebody. Processing information, sure. Analytical thinking, getting ideas from other people, negotiating, what else?
Defending our reason.
Yeah. How did I tell you to organize yourselves? What process did I tell you to follow? I just said get in a group and figure it out, right? So, I mean, it wasn't like you had this cookie-cutter process to follow. In other words, you got to create your own solution to a problem. And probably draw from your understanding of life, biology, whatever, things you've read, negotiating with somebody else. See, that's rigor and relevance in action, as opposed to the lecture, which is kind of, you know, I talk, you listen. Something to think about. Earlier on, I talked about professional development. A lot of PD is quadrant A. The trainer presents the learning strategies, the teacher listens. Think about what happens in the other quadrants. Quadrant B, where the teacher applies the learning strategies in their classes, or quadrant C, where the teacher might analyze student performance and select appropriate strategies, or quadrant D, where they're actually using the strategies, evaluating student performance, giving feedback to the kids, modifying to meet the realities. See, we have to, if we want our teachers to be in a classroom teaching in all four quadrants, when we do training for them, we got to get out of quadrant A. I mean, if our faculty meeting looks like us reading memos, then teachers are going to hand out worksheets. So part of what I try and do in staff development is to say, how can we emulate the kind of learning that we want to see? That's sort of what brought me to the publishing, because we wanted to start collecting student work, bringing back, looking at it, because we were going to publish it. It was a way of looking at student work and evaluating student work. See, I think this PD model ought to be the precursor to the classroom rigor and relevance model. And again, if we get back to that question I asked you as we started to process Survivor, I said, what was your objective? A lot of you didn't have one. See, what happens in many cases is we haven't kind of created our vision of teaching and learning. You do that first. You have to have conversations in that building talking about what's teaching and learning look like here. And then the organization becomes a reflection of that. You know, I frequently see a situation, or not frequently, but I have from time to time seen a situation where somebody decides it's going to be a really good idea to go to a block schedule, we'll say at a high school, and then they have to figure out, well, what do we do with the 60 minutes? Instead of saying, let's talk about the kind of classroom we want to have, and then what schedule will support that kind of teaching and learning. So I think as you talk about your essential skills as leaders, educational leaders, it's really about helping to craft that vision. And it's not your vision, it's really a shared vision. There's some great stuff to guide you, and I'm going to take you through just very quickly some of the kinds of things you can do in some core areas of learning based on the work of Bob Marzano, and they've done, I think, a great job of looking at classroom instruction that really works. I tend to focus on three essential skill areas, and these are the kinds of things I think you can carry back to work with your teachers on: defining, summarizing, and comparing. And what we're going to do is we're going to go through each strategy. I'm going to show you some examples of how that strategy can be used at different levels. So I'll throw some elementary and middle and high school examples in there. And then we'll talk about how to move them into those four quadrants to try and give you some ideas that you can share with your teachers as far as things they could be doing. Okay? Now notice I don't call this vocabulary. It's about negotiating meaning. That's what defining is. All right? And so here's the first question. If you think back about your building or your situation, to what extent do you agree with the statement, we've agreed on a set of common defining strategies to use with our students? And the test of that would be, if I were the new teacher there, you'd be able to say to me, this is how we teach defining here in our building. Okay, let's see what we have for response here. Okay, so sort of an interesting split, kind of skewed a little bit on the 60% of you disagree. Okay, so it sounds like in that case you have not. Now, what are we talking about? See, to me, a lot of defining is really vocabulary instruction. And we know kids need vocabulary, but a lot of it's done, like here, I'm going to teach you what the vocabulary is, instead of thinking that there's other ways to get defining into the other quadrants, like defining as a component of analysis, or as an opportunity to negotiate meaning with a peer, or to really modify meaning in a real-world context, since meanings are not absolute. Now, you're all probably very well aware that there's two primary components in defining skills that we want. Number one is we want to connect vocabulary with prior knowledge. That's the first thing. And the second is we want to give kids a chance to more deeply process. Now, if you're an elementary teacher, and I've spent the last 10 years in a lot of elementary buildings, this is stuff you understand. When you get up to middle or high school, though, your teachers are not thinking like this, because they don't teach this way. It's like, okay, here's the chapter, here's the glossary, you better know these terms for the test. Okay, they're in there, look them up. Okay, so this resonates differently at different levels of the program. Now, in terms of giving kids opportunities to make connections, what you really need to do is you need to give kids a chance to develop their own definitions and to compare them with their peers. That's what we're talking about. It's about what does the child do with that term before you pull out the glossary, before the teacher tells them what's going on. How is that term introduced to them? For example, let's say we had third grade students and they are going to go through a little process. They're going to negotiate a definition for longhouse before the book comes out. And so one student says this, another student says that, a third student says that, and then, you know, they kind of come up with a definition. In other words, they pooled their thinking before the teacher said this is the correct definition. Now, in order to give you a little chance to try that, I've got a word for you. Adultessen. And I would like you, sitting there with someone nearby, to negotiate the meaning of the word adultessen. And I'd like you to keep track of kind of the steps you followed. Okay? So here's a brand new term. Class, we have a new term today. It's adultessen. Can you say the word, please? Adultessen. Okay, I'd like you to sit here with a partner, and I would like you to develop a definition for the term quickly, and I would like you to think about or remember some of the steps or the stages. So please begin. Okay, I'd like you to stop now. Will someone tell us sort of the steps or maybe some of the intermediary definitions that they came up with, some of the ideas that they shared? Someone? Come on.
Break down the word into the roots, the two parts that you think.
And what are some of the things that you broke it down into?
We got to that part, and we look at adult, obviously, and we're trying to figure out what is the essence part, what do we want to...
Okay, so you had the adult part, and you had the essence part, you were still working on it. What else did somebody come up with? Yes, sir?
Well, it kind of related to pubescent, and the word adult, and it's a stage in human development that would come after pubescence, more toward the adult, and with the stem word being adult, and so it would be a category of human development, say, from 18 to 20.
Okay, and you?
Just big picture, we thought of people who reflect that term. We came up with friends or names of people who we assume reflect that term.
Well, what does the term mean, so I know that they reflect it?
Well, I think it was more reactionary than breaking it down. So maybe our group, or me personally, was whole learning as opposed to part learning.
Okay, all right. Well, what I've just done is I've asked you to negotiate a preliminary definition. Now, I'm going to show you the correct definition for adultessen, and then what I'm going to want you to do is I want you to compare your preliminary definition with the correct definition, okay? So this is the definition of adultessen. This is going to be in your test on Friday, okay? Now, was your definition very similar to this one?
Yeah.
How so?
We looked at adult and we looked at adolescent and kind of thought it might be either a separate group that focuses on adults or some connection between the two.
Okay. And you thought it was a stage of life, correct? Okay. Well, my point is this. First of all, I made up the word adultessen, okay? And I made up the definition because I thought, well, if I pick a word that you know that's a real word, then some wise guy in the room is just going to know what the word means. So I'll fix them. I'll make up a word. Okay? But the point is, that by giving you an opportunity to try and construct the meaning before we pull out the dictionary, you are connecting with prior knowledge. And you're also telling students that, you know, it's not about waiting for what the right word, you know, what the right definition is. In fact, they're learning new words every day in context with their friends, and new slang and new IM speak and whatever, you know. What does LOL mean? You know, I mean, how did you figure that out? I mean, somebody finally explained it's laugh out loud. So the key point is we want to get teachers to spend some time doing these kinds of things. For example, a great activity is a list group label, where let's say I've got a high school or a middle school classroom. I say, okay, we're going to be studying revolutions. What I'd like to do is we're going to take a moment. I'd like you to brainstorm all the words you can think of when you think of the word revolution. And then what I'd like you to do is, working with a partner, I want you to group those words and see if you can come up with some headings for those groups. So words or phrases. Again, this is the list group label. This is a great way to connect with prior knowledge. It involves a categorization. It can be done very quickly. I'll kind of show you a visual of it later in the presentation. Now, once kids start to have new ways to be connected with words, we get into the processing skills. How do you spend more time processing them? For example, you can use something like a Frayer model here, where the students define in their own words, give some characteristics, examples and non-examples. A non-example is a powerful learning tool. You know, this is what culture is not. Culture is not the weather. Culture is not the color of my skin. Okay? And again, it's done in the students' own words. So giving teachers a tool like this to use, and there's lots of different models. I've got a lot of them online you can look at. Even having kids design their own model. This, I think, is a great, great tool. This is from Strong and Silver, personal vocabulary notebook, and I'll show you how it works. I'm going to give you a high school example, but we've done it with third graders. You start with giving kids a term. Either the term is generated through the reading, the teacher gives them the term, the student identifies it as a term that they're not sure of the meaning of. Somehow you find a reason for that term being there. And the first thing you do is you ask the student to define in their own words what that term means before they look it up. So I want you to think about the term. In this case, it's segregation. And I'd like you to think about the definition that this child is given, a time when African Americans used to have separate schools. And I'd like you to think about whether this student understands what the word segregation means. Okay? So, do you think this student has a good understanding for the meaning of the word segregation? A time when African Americans used to have separate schools. Okay, let's see how we voted here. Okay, kind of divided. Anyone want to tell us why they either agreed or disagreed? It's kind of a 2-to-1 agreed. Anybody? Yeah.
I fully disagree because you can segregate apples and oranges, and you can separate things, and so it doesn't just have to be based on.
Okay. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
Segregation also went beyond public schools, public institutions.
Okay.
You said a good understanding.
Yeah, does this student have a good understanding with segregation?
Behind there, you didn't have a deeper understanding.
Okay, and back here?
I was thinking that...
Oh. That's all right. You two don't have to fight over it. Either one of you.
Well, I was thinking that the student understood segregation for that, but not could carry it over to anything else.
Okay. And you were going
to
say? Okay. Well, this is where the learning takes place, because the student goes to get the dictionary definition, and now the key is, here's the learning. The student is asked to write about the comparison between their definition and the dictionary definition. What the child reveals in this is that they thought segregation was like a time period. You know, like the Golden 20s or something, or the Great Depression. It was the time of segregation. So they thought it was referring to a time period. See, and this is something we don't do enough of with kids, are those reflective questions. What did you learn? How did you learn it? It's all about the content, not them as learners. Okay? So we also need to think about the use of familiar terms in specialized contexts. You know, as we move from area to area, the meanings of words change. One of the problems we have with our high school kids is our high school kids are getting out of school and they're going off to college and they're switching to three different schools and taking 6 years to get through, if they get through at all. And part of the reason is that they've not become independent learners. They've not learned to negotiate meaning. They assume everything's got a right answer. Let's just take the word model. Now, if we use model in this context, what does model mean when we talk about this model airplane? What are the attributes of being a model here? It's what? All right, it's a replica, but by replica, we mean what about it? It's smaller, and? Well, it's not real. Is it functional? Do we think this is going to fly? No. But what should it be very accurate about?
Scale.
Okay, so it's a smaller scale model. It doesn't have to function. And it shows us what something looked like in the relationships. In fact, probably inside here, there's probably not a model of the motor and everything. It's just the exterior. All right, let's look at this model of a tsunami. What does model mean in this context? Is this a scale model? In other words, are we saying that the house is going to be this big in relationship to the wave? So is this to scale? What's it modeling? A process. This model's a process. If we were in an economics class and we were looking at the supply and demand model, in this case it's scalper's tickets, what we're modeling here is the correlation between, you know, price and quantity demanded at different prices. I mean, so it's a relationship. And yet when we pull out the dictionary, this is the dictionary definition we get a model. So one of the problems we have in our programs, especially because our programs at the high school level and really beginning up through middle school are very term laden, but kids are not developing deeper understandings of terms and how they mean different things in different contexts. They're just memorizing what the word means. And if they come across another use of it, kind of the wheels come off. Now here's another question to pose. Do you have a common academic vocabulary list? This is a project I did with the middle school where we identified terms of the day, a word of the day. In this case, we use Latin root words in the month of October. The Latin root word was durare, meaning to harden. And that week in school, from the 4th through the 7th, every day, teachers in every class use the word endure on Monday, endurance on Tuesday, durable, and then duration on Thursday. Every teacher used the same word, all based on the same Latin root word. So here's a question for you. Would it be a good idea if you organized a common academic vocabulary list? And if you're at the elementary level, I'm not just talking about a sight reading list. I'm talking about what these words actually mean. Would that be a good idea for your school? Let's see how people voted. A fair amount of agreement. You know what's interesting? When I pose this question to teachers and I'm out doing workshops, invariably teachers agree. And a lot of principals don't even know that teachers would be very willing to do this. And there's some great source material. Going back to Bob Marzano, he's got a book called Building Academic Vocabulary. It's an ASCD book. He's got lists of words at different levels in different subject areas. And what schools are doing is they're just photocopying the list. They're sending it around to the teachers. They're saying, circle the ones you think we all ought to use. They're quickly getting some consensus, and now suddenly we've got a much more broad-based teaching of defining skills and academic vocabulary. The other thing you need to do is monitor the accuracy of the student work. And to give kids opportunities to check their own progress and to look for misconceptions and areas of confusion. This is an example. We were working with fourth graders, and we were at the midpoint in a study on electricity. And so the question, we just wanted a real quick way to check for understanding. So we asked the kids working in groups to tell us two things. If you were discussing electricity, what words would you use? And put that on one list. And then we said, what words might you find in a book about electricity? And what was very interesting is the words that they were using, it sort of became three lists for us. It became the words they knew, the words they recognized that they weren't sure of the meaning, and the third list was the words that didn't make it on either list, which were actually some of the words we had studied. So very quickly, in 15 minutes, teachers got an insight into the level of understanding that kids had for those words. In other words, they really knew them, they kind of recognized them and said, well, they'd be in a book on electricity, but I don't know, I'm not sure what they mean, or they didn't make it to the list at all. A lot of the teachers found out that the kids were learning a lot more than they thought. Again, a check for understanding. You can also try another approach. You could give the students a self-evaluative rubric from level 4, where they understand the term even more than when it was taught. They know multiple meanings, down to level 1, where I really don't know what this word means. And then perhaps if you were using this particular tool, that student might have self-assessed themselves with a 3. And then while they were going through this unit, they might be keeping track of their levels of understanding of various words. Again, is a chance for kids to self-assess. And then, of course, the key thing is really finalizing it. To ask kids, how has their understanding of the word changed over time? How would they use it in real life? What sort of personal connection can you make? This is really essential. Now, the curious thing that happens, and this happens all the time, teachers will tell me, these are all really great ideas, but what? We don't have the time. So this is where you as instructional leaders can really make a difference. In other words, somebody's got to step up to the plate and say, these are the essential words kids need to be learning at this level. Because frankly, there's a lot of important stuff, and there's a lot of stuff that are just filling up the textbooks. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is somebody's got to do a little cost-benefit analysis here, because frankly, if we're blasting through all these words and at the end of the unit the child, you know, maybe got 50% of them right, and 2 weeks from now they don't remember any of them, my question to you is, how much time were we saving by going fast? Because in the end, they didn't know half the words anyway. So why not have us kind of plow through, make some judgments about the words to use, and then do them well. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to move defining out of this spot here and into all four quadrants to really show kids and teachers that it's a lot more about negotiating meaning in the real world than it is about, you know, learn the term but you don't have to think about it, which is unfortunately what I think happens a lot. Now, what I thought we would do is this. I don't want you to pull a big disappearo here, but why don't we just stand for a second and stretch or get a glass of water. We'll give ourselves a little 2-minute break, okay? Because it's a long time to sit, huh? Again, we are going to start up in just a couple minutes, so don't run too far. How are we doing? All right. Got a lot to do today. I've got a lot of stuff for him, and I'm trying not to go too fast. Is it going too fast? Or no. Good. Okay. All right, good. So how's it going here? Good? You getting some good stuff out of this?
Yeah? I wanted to let you know we're doing small learning communities at our high school.
Oh, are you?
And a lot of your work off of your website has been used.
With the Ninth Grade Academy stuff? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a nice little video that, I don't know if you've seen the interview with the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a video that you can download, and it's just interviews I did with teachers and students about the Ninth Grade Academy. And it really, I think you see that the teachers were on the same page, that they understood their purpose. I mean, in other words, they had a goal. They had forged a vision for learning, and then were sort of operating with it. And that's very important. And I think what's nice about it is it's 10 minutes long. It's teachers talking to teachers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I need to use that.
Good,
next week.
Good. It's there. Yeah, great. Ooh, look out there. How's it in the back of the room here? We having fun back here? Everybody okay?
Yeah.
We getting some good ideas?
Yeah, good ideas.
All right. Great. Good. Okay, well, I'm going to round up our friends, and we're going to get started here. You want to give them the high sign, Will? Tell them to come on in here. We'll get going. A little candy will help you there, huh?
Yeah. Keep the juice going.
Yeah. Okay, why don't we get started again? We are going to be talking about summarizing. Now, again, just to put this in context, we're talking about strategies that can be used in different disciplines and different levels. I've got three that we're going to be looking at: defining, summarizing, and comparing. So this is strategy area number two. And by summarizing, we're talking about synthesis and judgment. This is sort of my definition of summarizing. So I'm going to pose this question to you again. You're back at the building. The question is, we've agreed on a set of common summarizing strategies to use with our students. Okay, we have common summarizing strategies to use with our students, and we'll close the polls here in a second. Yeah, I wonder if this is how the voting works. You just click for your local congressperson? Yeah, right. This is probably about as accurate as that, actually. Yes. Okay, so again, surprise. And this is the kind of results I see most everywhere I go, which is we really expect kids to summarize, but nobody's ever taught them how to do it. And it doesn't seem to matter what level we're at. Now, what are we talking about with summarizing? Well, to some extent, summarizing frequently is a quadrant A activity. Okay, I want you kids to look at chapter 5. I want you to put down 5 main ideas. You know, what do? They go to the bold print, copy them out, you know. May not even know why or what they're doing. Very lower order thinking, not a lot of judgment on their part, kind of a guess what I'm thinking sort of thing. But realize that summarizing is really key to analysis, that it's certainly something that's done in negotiation with the material that you're looking at. I mean, you as adult readers, you know, you read something, you start to say, gee, you know, do I agree with this? Do I disagree with this? Where's this person coming from? I mean, right away you're sorting and sifting. And certainly summarizing could be a quadrant D activity in a situation like a debate, where you actually have to listen to somebody before you decide what you're going to say back. Now, there's a research basis here. And again, we're kind of using Bob Marzano's work as our research foundation. But what they're showing is that summarizing is one of the most powerful instructional strategies you can use to build content knowledge. Meaning that if I lectured to this class here on the essential characteristics of mammals, and then I told you guys to go in the next room to take the test on the characteristics of mammals, and then I asked you guys to go through a summarizing activity. The research says we get a 34% gain on the content knowledge with this group. It's like summarizing is like hitting the save button in their brains. It forces them to think about it and to do something with it. Now, it's more than accuracy, though. It's not just did you get the facts right. It's about creativity. It's about judgment. You use it in coordination with other strategies. It's a very, very powerful tool. Now, as part of this, one of the things that I find, especially as we get up into middle school and high school, is that kids don't know why they're reading things. As adult readers, you know why you read something. I mean, you're going to read a contract much differently than you're going to read the horoscope, right? Because there's a purpose there that's different. What I've found is I've worked with schools and teachers to actually agree on a common form to utilize when they're giving assignments, especially at the high school level. Kids don't know why they're reading something. Why not have a very simple form that the teachers worked on with you that was a check-off kind of thing where you could go through and very quickly lay out the reading for the students so that students understood what they were supposed to get out of the reading. What was the purpose of the reading? What sort of text features should we be looking for in the reading? Because one of the reasons they can't summarize is they don't even know why they're reading it to begin with. In fact, the real reason they're reading it is somebody gave it to them to read. And you know what the teachers will tell you? They'll say the kids aren't doing the reading. Well, the other interesting thing is if the teacher has to go through this, it forces them to ask a real tough question, which is, why am I assigning this? Am I just assigning it because I'm supposed to be giving them reading to read? So this serves another purpose from an administrative point of view. It gives a reflection on the teacher's part to say, what's the purpose? What should kids do when they're done reading this? Or do I just assign it because I'm teaching the next chapter, so I got to tell them to read the next chapter the day before? Okay? Now, another thing I'd like to stress is that it's not just about reading. It's about looking at things. It's about listening to things. And summarization can occur in all three. So saying, looking at a work of art and saying, so what the artist is saying is no different intellectually than saying, so what the speaker is saying or what the author is saying in writing. They're all the same intellectual process. And see, one of the lost opportunities we have with kids is that they're good at listening and looking at things, but they might be struggling readers. So why aren't we building the summarizing skills visually or auditorily so we can then transition the skill to reading? So a lot of what I've done is tried to give people strategies for doing this. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Roger Essley. He's an author illustrator. He's also dyslexic, and he kind of suffered as a poor student. But in New York State, where I'm from upstate New York. I probably should have mentioned that earlier. But in New York State, we have a listening section on our ELA exams. So we're all about listening up there. And we did some work with Roger, and Roger had this great idea of doing telling boards, which are these little sort of note-taking using images and little pictures that the kids drew. So this is something from the eighth grade exam up in New York a couple years ago, and these are the notes that a student took. And I'm going to tell you, well, I'm going to sort of read what the student was listening to in a highly abbreviated format, okay? Josephine Dixon married Earl Dixon. He was a cotton buyer. Josephine, you know, used to be a little bit clumsy in the kitchen, around the house. She'd sometimes get injured. And when Earl came home, he would tend to her cuts or things like that. And back in 1920, the way you did that was you got out a piece of tape and you got out some cotton and you put the cotton on the tape and you tended to the wound. Well, Earl got an idea that you could put the cotton on the tape ahead of time. And so what he did is he set up a bunch of little pieces of tape with cotton, left them home for Josephine. She could take care of herself. It turns out he went to Johnson & Johnson and said, hey, I have an idea for something. Let's call it Band-Aids. They liked it. They made a lot of money, and Earl became vice president of the company. These are the notes a kid took. One of the things we found is when we started encouraging teachers to utilize this strategy and we worked with kids, what we found is two things happened. Number one, the comprehension level of many students soared. What really surprised us is some of the teachers started using it as a pre-writing activity. In other words, sketch the outline to what you're going to write. Again, a dramatic increase in the quality of the writing. Okay, because kids were able to tap into their visual summarizing skills. In fact, when we started talking about summarizing, we started telling everybody, guess what, we're all teaching summarizing. We all have opportunities to use rather different means to show kids that there's ways to visually summarize. Let's just try this out a little bit as an experience here. I'm going to walk you through it so you can feel what it's like. If we were to take a look at an image, one of the first things that we want kids to do is we want to take a closer look at the image. We kind of want to slow down because kids look at things really quickly. We want to look at some different sections. You know, we want to focus in on details. And the third thing we want to do is we want to give kids a very discrete task. Okay? And in this case, I want them to identify people, objects, and activities. So what I've got is an enlargement of this image. I have some areas I've just sort of arbitrarily boxed to just sort of suggest details that you focus in on. And I'd like you not to give me any inference, okay, but just literally in terms of what do you see, tell us some of the people, objects, and activities. Okay, class?
Boys.
Okay, so you see boys?
Uniforms.
Uniforms. Plants, I heard somebody say. What else?
It's cold.
It's cold. Why do you say it's cold? Okay. What else do you see?
Standing upright.
All right, they're all standing upright. No smiles. There's a house in the background. Anything else you see? Okay, it looks like they're at attention, yeah? All right, there's a fence. Okay, now what I would do is I would now move it up to the inferential level. Anyone tell us what they think is going on, where this is? Questions they'd want to know more about. We're moving from the literal to the inferential. Somebody. All right, you said an orphanage. Now, what is it that you see in the picture that tells you it's an orphanage?
Maybe it's the uniforms and no adults.
Uniforms and no adults. Somebody else want to tell us what they think they're looking at? Anybody?
Worker camp where kids being brought to work in the fields.
Okay, worker camp where kids are being brought to work in the fields. What is it that you see that tells you that?
Obviously the fields, the kids all uniformly and in order, you know, getting ready to be put out to work.
Okay. Anyone have some idea where or when this is? Anybody? You're saying the early what? Why do you say the early 1900s?
Looking at the style of the shoes, the knickers, pants popular at that time. Looks like a well in the back being used by, I guess, Fulcrum.
Okay, so he's talking about the shoes, the pants, the knickers. He thinks it's the early 1900s. Okay. Now, notice what I just did. I continually asked people what they thought they were looking at, and what's the question I always ask next? Well, specifically, I said what? What is it that you see that makes you think that way? Okay, you know? And see, that's where you're probing for the summarization. Tell me what you see that makes you think that. Now, as it turns out, these are inmates at a New York State prison. This is actually not far from me. It's a prison that I've worked in recently, though now it's surrounded by barbed wire and it has kids that have done some pretty bad things. These are kids that were probably like street kids, waifs, you know, pickpockets, petty theft, whatever. But the key thing was that we went from the literal, objective, what do you see, to the inferential, trying to get kids to summarize and extract information. Now, we can move right up through Bloom very easily, okay? Again, using visual skills. here's the setup for this exercise, and we'll do this quickly. Let's suppose it's the 1930s. You work at Life magazine. You are the assignment editor, the photo assignment editor. You've sent a photographer out to shoot some pictures. She's come back with four photographs. You have to pick one of them to illustrate a story on the plight of the farm workers, the migrant farm workers. Okay, and what I'm going to do here is I'm going to just kind of sequence through four pictures. And what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to think about which of these four pictures you would choose to illustrate the plight of the farm workers. Okay, we'll go through one more time. Again, you have to pick one. Okay, so I'm going to ask you to pick one of them, and we're going to vote on them in a second here. So you've got your pick here in your head somewhere. Okay, so I'd like you to vote on which of the four pictures you would pick. You just got little thumbnails of them here. Okay, I think we got most everybody here. Let's close the polls and look at the count. Okay, so this actually didn't show up a bar. Not good, but there is 37% here. So, so it was actually rated in order. One was most chosen, two, three, four. Somebody want to tell us why they picked, I'm just going to back up to these enlargements here. A lot of you picked one. Why?
Oh, wait, I picked two.
Well, then tell us why you picked two.
I struggled with one and two, and I opted for two because, one, you could see the children in the background, but you couldn't see them as clearly, and I wanted to go with the picture that showed the shanty housing, but I wanted it to be seen that this plight impacted children, so I wanted children.
Okay, so a closer up shot. So she's torn between one and two. Some of you picked one. Why? Anybody? Yeah.
I think it gave more information about the complete picture being homeless as well as hungry and the entire family. It gave just a more complete.
So what is it that you saw there that made you think it gave you a more complete picture?
You saw more of the visual that they're actually living there, whereas the other pictures, you know, they could be sitting out on the farm working. You don't get a picture that they're at home.
Okay. So this one then gives you a little context of where. Okay, anybody else? Yeah.
I chose two because of the eye contact. You couldn't avoid having a connection with that.
Okay. And I think you heard her. It was because of the eye contact. She picked two. Anybody pick three for a reason? Some of them? Anybody? Yeah.
I did for the exact opposite reason. I said the lack of eye contact just seemed to be more despondent.
Okay. And how about anyone choose four? Not a lot. Okay. Now, obviously, what I would want to do with a group of students here, which we didn't do to begin with, we're doing evaluation. We're doing Bloom's evaluation, and we've never created the rubric. I mean, we've never created the sort of tool. So, for example, which is more powerful, eye contact or no eye contact? You know, we have to agree on that. Curiously enough, let me just go back through the voting here. This is the picture that they picked. This is number five. I didn't show this one to you. Okay? And you've seen this, haven't you? Right? So again, it's using visuals, visual skills to look in and extract information to decide what's important. And you people were really talking about what's important. Is it important to see where they are in the background? Is it important to see their faces up close? Is eye contact important? Isn't it? We could then go into this image and we could talk, you know, well, why is it that this is the image that really became famous? There were actually six pictures that Dorothea Lange took, and one of them is not available to the public. I'm not quite sure why. Let's ask another question. Does your school use common discussion group techniques? Because remember I said summarizing is not just about reading, but it's also about listening and looking, okay? So just as a what if, suppose I walked into one of your classrooms and said, okay, kids, I want you to go into a fishbowl. We're going to have a fishbowl discussion. Would your kids know what to do? Okay, let's see what we get here. No. Why? Well, because we haven't taught them what a fishbowl is. Now, is it that I just picked one your guys don't do, you know, that your kids don't know, or is it that nobody's bothered to take time to teach them discussion groups? I have been in classrooms with teachers on a block schedule, like a middle school Spanish teacher. I have seen, you know, middle school kids, and you know how squirrely they can be, and I have seen them move to three different transitions flawlessly. And I've been in awe, and I've said to the teacher, how do you get your kids to do that? You know what the answer is? I train them how to do that. I tell them what the purpose is, what the roles are, and they just do it. So one of the questions that comes up is, as you look at various discussion group techniques, to what extent are your teachers getting together, talking about the techniques that work, talking about how to manage the technique, and then spending some time to actually wrestle with the question, well, if we were all going to use the same technique, how would we set it up? What would we call it? What would the roles be? Why aren't we using that same process as we move from class to class? Why is every teacher stuck reinventing the wheel? If I ask a lot of teachers about discussion groups, they say we don't use them because they're not productive. The kids just hang out. The reason they do is nobody's sort of got the act together to say this is how to do them. That's a key role as an instructional leader. That's something that you can do. You can teach questioning techniques. You can talk about the difference between a clarifying and a verifying question. I mean, there's wonderful stuff out there on this. You can give them a technique like a 4-2-1 free write where you have four kids, they're all given the same source information, they all look at one main idea, then one and two get together and they try and negotiate a common idea, they try and negotiate a common idea, eventually all four of them reach some consensus, and then there's a free write where they explain that idea to someone who did not do the reading. What if every teacher in your building knew this technique and could use it? Wouldn't the kids naturally just kind of move through it in a much more effortless way? See, really, this is what discussion groups do. It gives kids a chance to rehearse their thinking. That's really what an effective group does. It's also, the learning takes place during the negotiation of the meaning. Identifying, again, if summarizing is synthesis and judgment. And most importantly, kids need consistent structure and training for effective groups. And somebody ought to be providing that to them. You could be modeling that in your faculty meetings. Many teachers I work with, especially at the secondary level, do not have much of a repertoire of discussion group techniques at all. I mean, their idea of a large group discussion is guess what I'm thinking. You know? And I don't mean it in a negative way. I just don't think anyone's ever taught it to them. So here's a question. And again, this is the way we look for some consensus. Would it be a good idea if we use common discussion group techniques? Let's take a look at the results. Okay, a lot of you agree. You know what's interesting? I've been able to use this technique, come in, work with the faculty for a day or two, pose some of these questions, gather the consensus, and guess what? People know where to go next. A lot of times, teachers are willing to do these things. No one's really asked them. And it's been done through these crazy committee meetings and all these studies and things, task forces and, you know. So, I mean, a simple way of posing some strategies to people, asking them how they feel about it, it really gives you as an instructional leader a next step. Guess what? Most white people would use a common academic vocabulary list. They would use common training this way. Okay? Strategies to map text structure. Do you remember we talked about introducing the reading a little bit earlier? Okay. That form. Well, one of the problems that kids have is nobody's bothering to talk to them about text structure. They don't understand the underlying context of what they're reading. And I would suggest to you that there are, you know, probably half a dozen really common text structures that kids are going to encounter in their reading. And what successful schools are doing is they're taking time to teach their teachers about this. They're giving kids opportunities to use these on a consistent basis, and everybody uses the same system. So they talk about, you know, what a comparison looks like, what the keywords are. They go one step further, and they actually have graphic organizers associated with each text structure. And so what the student does is when they get the reading assignment, they're invited either by the teacher telling them or through a brief activity, you know, a quick sight reading of the material in the classroom to say, what text structure do you think this is and why? And then say, okay, we're going to use our sequence organizer or something like that. In fact, what I've seen schools do, there was one I was working with where they took it one step further that I love, is the kids, this was a middle school, the kids actually designed graphic organizers. They had a contest, a peer-evaluated contest among the kids, and the winning designs were put on the notebook covers for the next year because they printed their own notebook covers. So every kid had a whole set of student-designed graphic organizers right on their notebooks. A neat idea. What do you think? Should we use some common text structure maps? Would that make a difference? Let's see how you felt. Okay, again. And you know what? Faculties usually vote this way. Suddenly you've got some consensus. Hey, here's something we can do. This isn't hard. Okay, what are we trying to do? Well, in summary, we're trying to get summarization out of Quadrant A and look at ways to negotiate a common version, summarize a real-life process, analyze the elements of an image, perhaps in support of some higher-level thinking. Okay, this brings us to our last strategy. Hey, it's the home stretch, guys. Comparing and classifying, which is really about assessing similarities and differences. You know, our brains cannot stop comparing things. If I picked two pictures, as I did, and put them up here, this is a Civil War picture, and this is first responders at 9/11. Notice what your brain starts doing. That's the nature of being human. It's how we construct meaning. We compare things. So right away, you start looking at the parallels. It's very, very easy to do, okay? The research in Bob Marzano shows that the number one instructional strategy to build content knowledge is giving kids a chance to make comparisons. Number one strategy, most powerful learning tool you can utilize in your classroom. So, for example, where we want to be is in the math classroom where the teacher gives the kids two squares, a 1x1, a 2x2, and three rectangles, gives them the perimeter of each and the area of each, and then asks the kids to write what they see. And kids actually dig into the information and say, this is what's going on. They begin to see some relationships. They begin to see how things compare. That's what we want kids to be able to do. Now, here's a sample exercise. Let's say that we were studying regions of the world, and I gave the kids a list of some components of the Amazon rainforest, some features of the Amazon rainforest, no frost, average temperature, hot spider monkey. So you see we got animals, plant, climate stuff. And then I gave them some on the Mojave Desert. Okay? And then I gave them a graphic organizer called Rainforest and Desert Climate, and I asked them to identify the items that would go here, here, and here. So the kids generating that. And then I gave them one called Animals, and I asked the kids to generate what was going to go here, here, and here from the list. So again, I gave them a list. I gave them two blank graphic organizers, just labeled Amazon, Rainforest, Mojave Desert, and both. My question to you is, what quadrant would you put this activity in? A, B, C, or D? Remember, lower order thinking is A and B, higher order thinking C and D. A and C are kind of low on the relevance scale, very teacher-centric. B and D are more student-centered, highly relevant. Where would you put it? Okay, so I want you to think about that, and I'd like you to vote. Okay, let's see how we did here. We got all the votes in? All right, the polls are closed. And what did we get? Well, we got nearly half of you said it was C, right up here. And that would mean it's what, higher or lower order thinking? Higher order, and is it school-centered or student-centered? School-centered. Okay. So about and then another 22% of you thought it was here. So actually, that 68, two-thirds of you thought it was higher order thinking. Okay? About a third of you thought it was lower order thinking. Okay? Anyone want to tell us why they put it in one of those spots? Yeah. Okay. And so in that case, tell me about the level of bloom. I mean, why is that lower order?
I just see them taking it from a graph organizer that's already been given. As long as they know which column it came from, they can just transfer it to the same.
Okay. So a bat's on both lists, so bat goes on both.
Yeah.
Okay. Some other thoughts? Anybody else? No? All right. Do you agree with her? No? So you don't agree with her, but you don't want to tell us why? What is this like? You have a secret plan here that you're going to... Nobody can know. I have a reason, but you can't know it. Even though two-thirds of the people in this room agree with me, I can't tell you because I really couldn't share that. Somebody want, and I want to hear from somebody other than this guy. No, no. You're good, but I want to hear from somebody else. Most of you put it up in C and D. Why? Somebody. There's two-thirds of you. Say it in unison. What?
Even though they're given a list, you still have to process where it would go and process just getting the categories. So I would say that's the important.
Okay, so that's high-order thinking. That's analysis. And you want to say what, Joe?
I put it in B. I mean, I think it's relevant, but I don't think it's really thinking outside the box, and you're just kind of grouping.
Okay, so you put it as lower order thinking, but a little more student-centered. Okay, and you, Melissa.
I said C, because in a previous thing you had mentioned that that's where graphic organizers fall under.
Okay, so if it's a graphic organizer, it's higher order thinking because it's analysis. Okay. Well, I'm going to come at this a slightly different way. I would say it really depends on how this was done. But one thing I know for sure is that who really did the thinking in this exercise? Whoever designed it did the thinking, right? Why? Because what did they have to do?
They labeled
They had to get all the information, pull it together, develop the graphic organizer. They sort of, you know, they had to pull it all together. Now, depending on what level this was, I mean, is this a fourth grader? Is this a 10th grader? When in the unit it was taught, it might move around. But I would really like to come at this another way, okay, in a couple regards. Number one is just because something has a graphic organizer in it doesn't mean it's higher order thinking. In fact, the real higher order thinking in a graphic organizer is whoever decides what organizer to use and the components that are going to go into it. That's the higher order thinking. I mean, I was a social studies teacher. I must have taught the three regions of colonial America until I was blue in my, you know, the face. And the kids just knew that there was a spot, you know, the north had rocky, you know, rocky terrain, and so they got into shipping. You know, I mean, that it was just a mantra, something they just said back at you. I don't think they really thought about what it meant. Another important question is, are kids simply memorizing what they've already been taught that, and then putting it in the right spot in the graphic organizer? Or are there different ways to interpret it? If everything has a correct place to be, then there really isn't any thinking going on, is there? Because this has to be here. And here's the key. What's the point of the comparison? We don't, you know, comparisons have reasons. You learn things through them. So why is it that this comparison, what did it show us? What did it tell us about life in the desert and life in the rainforest? What did we learn from that? Or did we just learn bats live everywhere? Now, I'm going to flip this around. Now, I know you teach different levels here, but let's just say we were to take high school freshmen. And we had studied regions of the world. We had identified different factors like climate and topography and culture, whatever. And then I said to the kids, okay, I want you to go back and I want you to pick two regions of the world from all the regions we studied. I want you to develop a model to compare the regions. I want you to select the factors we're going to use to compare. And I want you to develop graphic organizers to display your comparison. So again, we scaffolded it a little bit, we modeled it, we got all the terms out there, they knew where all the resources were, but now they had to come back and they had to develop independently a model of this. My question to you is that a freshman of average ability could do this. To what extent do you agree with that? They could develop that model and present it to you in a logical fashion. Okay. So we've got 25 of you strongly agree, 54% here, and 21% disagree. So we got about a 3-1 on agreement. Now I'm going to ask you a slightly different question, but a related question. I think that most jobs in the 21st century workplace will require critical thinkers who can independently problem solve. To what extent do you agree with that? Okay. Now it's interesting. 75% of you strongly agreed with that. Only 25% of you strongly agreed a freshman could essentially do that task. So let's think about what this is telling us. What's it telling us? We've got freshmen that, what, can't? That are not critical thinkers who can independently problem solve, but we think that's the job that's going to be required. Now, when I work with faculties, I mean, I was in St. Louis last week, and, you know, I did this with a high school faculty. I got the similar results. I said to them, okay, you know what your job is? Your job is to get from there to there. You see? And this is what's happening, okay? We have a workplace that really requires independent thinkers. There's no jobs out there for filling out worksheets. There aren't. In fact, If you knew exactly, I mean, think about this. If there was a job where you came in and said, hey, thank you, Florine. Nice of you to join us here. Now, this is how we do things. You do it exactly this way. You always do it this way. You use this form. You fill it out, whatever. Now, I want you to do that. I'll come back and check on Friday. Now, who does that kind of job today? Or what does that kind of job today, the totally predictable, regimented job? A machine, a computer. Or they ship it off somewhere, right? My dad had a 10th grade education, dropped out of school, depression kid, went to work at Kodak up in Rochester, New York. Okay? Had a kind of an okay job. You know, middle class life. You know, I got to go to college. I was the first one in the family to go. We kind of had a station wagon. We lived in a nice house. Three kids. My mom worked, but, you know, she was on and off working. What jobs are there for 10th graders today? I mean, people with a 10th grade education today? I mean, are they living middle class lives and putting their kids through college and living in a nice house? Uh-uh. Okay. So this is the point that we have to make with our teachers. Because there's a disconnection between, see, they're so focused on the testing, and they're so focused on, I mean, and we've really done them a disservice in a way. Or to put it another way, we've given them a real excuse, which is to check all the boxes. Here's the form, I taught to this standard, I did this, I did that, and we're burying them in paper, and they're throwing the paper back, and I go places where there's these lesson planning forms with state standard, this point, that, or it's computerized, whatever. So all that stuff's happening, but guess what? The kids aren't learning to think. Not a pretty picture. So the question is, how do we give kids opportunities to develop their own analytic models? That's what it's all about. Analysis and thinking. Deciding what to be compared. I mean, we can scaffold it. We can say, okay, we're going to pick some of the criteria, but not others. We'll structure half the task, or we'll do the whole thing, but the next one you're going to do on your own. Okay? We can give them a very basic question. It could be done in every discipline. I mean, your physical education teacher could be asking kids, okay, I want you to develop a model of comparison to answer this question. You could be talking about which lunch is better. Here, develop a model to compare it. See, it's not about the content. It's about the act of having to make the comparison. That's where the learning takes place. The content's a bonus. It's the thinking that matters. You can make it very quantitative and real world. I had kids that were going out and looking at real world problems. We had a lot of data on countries. I asked a question. They actually went and developed their own research question. In this case, some kids looked at the relationship between wealth and infant mortality. They plotted it in Excel. They generated a graph. They said this has a negative correlation. This is average ninth graders that got to stand up there and do their two-minute presentation saying, I found a negative correlation between wealth and infant mortality. Here's what I think it means. Then, of course, you move up to classification, which to me is even better than comparing, because now it's about actually structuring things. See, this is the point we never tell anyone, which is all comparisons depend on classifications, but we never tell the kids what the classification systems are. Kids should be designing their own classification systems, and that can start very early. Frequently, we tell them what they can't compare. You know, there's all these rigid things. We say, well, this is how things should be compared, as opposed to inviting them. We give them somebody else's system to apply rather than generating one of their own. And ultimately, trying to answer the question, what's this tell us? You could start real simple. I mean, you could give a bunch of kids a pile of buttons and say, here, develop a classification system. Remember we talked about the list group label. I was in an intermediate class, and they did a list group label activity where the kids had to brainstorm all the things from the reading that they got out of it on separate little post-its. They went up to the whiteboard, and they started plunking their post-its up there and then circling and negotiating groups and labeling the groups. They developed a classification system. teacher said, watch, I can do this a different way for you, because her kids were trained. She gave them another exercise, except this time they had to negotiate the groups and the labels, but they couldn't talk to each other. Her kids were so well trained and so versed in the act of classifying that they developed classification systems non-verbally by just sort of moving post-its and writing things, and they could negotiate them that way. Okay? Here's a fifth grade student-centered vocabulary classification. Went into a classroom up in New York State. We kind of split the study of American history. We kind of go up to fourth grade, is up through pre-Civil War era, and you know, we've got Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony and the Erie Canal, so we got a lot of stuff to get into. So by fifth grade, they get into the Civil War. So went into the fifth graders, very quickly asked them if they remembered the study of slavery from last year, asked them to brainstorm in groups all the words they could think of when they heard the word slavery, words you might find in your reading, write the words on poster paper, we'll share them, and then the teacher guides them through creating groups of associated words, and so that's sort of what the kids are doing. They're all brainstorming words. And then, you know, the words are up there, and the teacher's now grouping the words. They're saying, well, gee, what words are the same on every list? Are there some groups we can put them into? And finally, what the teacher does is the teacher gets them to negotiate five different groups here, topics. So this was very teacher-directed, but it really walked through based on the words the kids had. And the next day, the teacher comes back with this graphic organizer that says violence towards slaves, life for the slave, etc., and asks the kids in groups to go back to the original words and put them in the right category. So Courtney's taking notes from this group, and under violence towards slaves, she puts the word hung and killing and blood, etc. You know, these are words the kids had generated the day before. Kids had collaborated on the categories. Now the second day, the kids are sorting the words back into the categories. All right? And so now kids are working on doing that. Also, another thing we added was additional words from text or discussion so they could add words later on, which is important. Now, what did we find out? Well, we found out that, first of all, kids had to sort between relevant words and unrelated words. Then they had to sort out some words that had to do with the lives of slaves, but there was a subset. I mean, we didn't tell them this, but there was not just the life of slaves, but the life of slaves that were violent, or aspects that were violent. Then other things about free the slaves and other things about important people. And of course, what did we find out? Well, some kids wrote Underground Railroad under the column violence towards slaves. Or they wrote Civil War as an unrelated term to slavery, you see? So what we did is we did a vocabulary exercise that allowed us to incorporate a categorization. It was very student-centered, and in doing so, we learned where the gaps were, and we could address them. So, again, the whole notion of giving kids a chance to classify. You can tie evaluation to classification. In this case, you could give them something like, okay, you're going to pick an MP3 player. You decide what the factors are. Here's the three choices. You actually develop the model. I mean, this is Consumer Reports, right? Let them design that and learn how to not only categorize and develop classification systems, but to use evaluation. Here's a question for you. I think our kids should have more opportunity to design their own comparisons and classifications. So let's see how people voted here. Yeah, and you know what you have to do? You just have to work with your teachers, talk to them about the whole nature of comparison, and the biggest thing you have to get past is this idea that if there's a graphic organizer there on the table that came out of the teacher's resource book, that the kids are doing analysis. They may be, they may not be. If the kid developed the graphic organizer, then I know they're doing analysis. Now, I always like to practice what I preach. So I'm going to put you through a little exercise. This is our concluding exercise, where I'm going to show you a painting. And you're going to use all your skills in defining, summarizing, and comparing to extract meaning from this painting. And the reason that you need to extract meaning is this painting is from the mid-19th century. It was done in upstate New York. It's in a museum right down the road from me. And if you walked into my home in the 1850s in upstate New York, you saw this painting, it would have really told you a story about my family. And it would have used symbols that were very common at the time. However, these symbols have been sort of lost to us. So we have to use all our summarizing skills, our comparison skills, to sort of dig in here and see if we can understand this. So here's a long shot of it. And what I'm actually going to do here is I'm going to cycle through some long shots and close-ups of the three characters. So I want you to be sort of observing, defining, like, what am I looking at, summarizing the important information, and most importantly, I want you to look for features that are unique or common among the three, because the way you're going to understand the symbolism is by extracting what's the same and what's different among these three. Okay, now I'm just going to, what am I going to do? I'm going to hit escape there and hit no. Okay, and I'm just going to back up. No, I didn't want to do that. Okay, so tell me what you're looking at. What do you see here? Especially, what do you see that's the same or different among these three? And are they the same? All right, they're all shiny. Are there any differences? All right, this one has two straps. These have one. What else do you see? All have rosy cheeks. That's the same. What? Off the shoulder dresses. Okay, what else do you see? Different in what way?
One girl has curls.
All right, curls, and these two have short hair. All right, one has got a hat.
One holds a doll.
This has got a doll. This one's holding, there's actually a rose there. This has a hobby horse with a little crop. See, there's a hobby horse there? Okay.
Pants on the
figure. Pants here. Pantaloons. Bare legs here and here. Okay. Okay, dark, light, light. Okay. Solid color, stripe. So, you've done a good job of observing things. You've looked at similarities and differences. Somebody want to put it together because there's a story here. And tell us what's going on. Yes, sir.
Is that her life stage? Is that the same person in all pictures?
So you're saying you think it might be the same person in three stages of her life. Tell me what you see that makes you think that. Okay. And then this is the oldest.
No, I think the old long hair is
there. Oh, this is older. So going from the youngest to the oldest. Okay. Somebody else. Another theory. Because there's something going on here. It told a very powerful story in the 1850s. And it's all right in front of you. See, this is rigor and relevance in action. I'm asking you to use your strategies to solve something you haven't solved before. Okay. What else we got? We've only got one theory. Same girl, different stages. Yeah.
It looks to me like the girl standing up is kind of looking over the other two girls, that she's kind of the guardian or the babysitter. Because the other two girls have their toys and they're playing, and she's kind of standing over them.
Okay. So this is about someone that's in sort of supervising these other two. Okay, how about a third theory? Yeah.
I'm seeing perhaps sisters and sisters who have unique personalities and are the two on the end are more consistent with the time, and for some reason the one in the middle just strikes me as being different and bold, and with her hat and her shorter hair and her stance, she just looks to me like a leader.
A leader. So you see something really different in this one with the hat, the darker clothes. Anyone see another character that really stands out? Yeah.
I think the one holding the child is the mother, and then the daughter, and then the other granddaughter.
All right, so you're saying mother, daughter, granddaughter? What's saying mother here to you? All right, the baby doll. But let me ask you a question. You know, we've got long hair, short hair, short hair. Pantaloons, no pantaloons, no pantaloons. Looking at you, and not looking at you. What's different about this character? She's sitting. The other two are standing. What else is different? What's going on with this character? Okay. I'm going to tell you what's going on with this character. Okay? This character is a girl. This is a boy. And this is a boy. Wait a minute. What do you mean you said it?
She said it to me.
Oh, so you have a witness. Well, why did you think that?
Just their face.
Okay. Look, long hair, short hair, short hair. Pantaloons, no pantaloons. Dressier dress. Holding the doll. Not looking at you. Sit, you know, kind of demurely sitting. Okay? This is the only girl.
Well, in that era, little girls would not have been holding a horse.
Oh, yeah. A hobby horse like this? No. That would have been a boy's object. So, there's one thing that's going on, which is this is the only girl. But there's something about this boy that's different. So, what's going on with this boy? No, and I don't mean this. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But no, but first of all, these are not boys dressed as girls. These are just boys in typical clothes in the 1850s and, you know, among the upper middle class. But what's really different about this boy? A hat, the dark outfit, the rose, the cross legs. There's another symbol. He's what? He's dead. You're right. This child is dead. This was a painting that was done probably by an itinerant painter who didn't have a great idea of proportions and all that. And somebody said, will you do a portrait of our three children? The oldest boy has died. We had another boy and another girl. And so they used all the symbols to show you what was going on. So actually, this is a deceased boy in the center. These are girls. So what I wanted to do... And it's hard because I have to say, now, how can I take a group of adults and put them through a rigorous and relevant activity where they're going to classify and do it in 10 minutes and they're not going to read something? It's a valiant attempt to say this is what your kids have to be doing, is your kids have to be trying to construct knowledge out of things, okay? Now, just to kind of move along, and we're going to vote, but I'm going to skip through that. We'll get to the conclusion, okay? You need to be thinking about professional development back in your buildings that's going to model what you want to see happening in the classroom. That's critical. If the PD is all sit and get, that's what the classrooms are going to look like. And just kind of a teaser question to send you out the door, okay? Talking about preparing kids for a future that we really can't describe, okay? What skills are you going to need? So we got a little competition out there. So what skills are we going to need? Well, we're going to need the basic skills. There's no doubt about it. We're going to need creativity. We're going to need some self-discipline. But here's what I think your kids are going to need more than anything else is adaptability right here. You know why? Because the days of that job that you were going to have for the rest of your life are over. So your kids have got to know how they learn. They've got to be connected to their learning. They've got to be reflective of their learning. Your teachers have got to be thinking about how they learn. everyone's got to always be focused on this whole notion of what's the learning environment, what's the vision for instruction, how are we structuring instruction, because in the future, people are going to move from job to job to job. They're going to need new skills. There's things they're going to have to learn that haven't even been invented yet. I want to remind you as you leave here that Willie's a very big guy, and he's going to be taking these from you. And I'd like to also point out that if I can give you a hand in your schools, certainly feel free to contact me. Some of the things I've been doing a lot of is rigor and relevance, content reading strategies, sort of literacy in the digital era. I spoke with someone here, Melissa, about some of the things I've been doing with ninth grade academies and small learning communities, instructional leadership. And the other thing that works very nicely is this audience response system as a great way to do some strategic planning, either with a leadership team or certainly with the full faculty. So I would love a chance to give any of you a hand. Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your conference. Turn in the clickers. Thank you.
You're welcome. Click it twice, does it register or read it twice?
It just takes the second one.
Okay.
Yeah. The other thing you can do with it is